Welcome to a new conversation about software engineering. Today I'm talking with Chris Richardson. Chris is a software architect and serial entrepreneur. He is a Java champion, a Java 1 rockstar, and the author of Pojos in Action. He was also the founder of the original Cloud Foundry, and early Java Pass for Amazon EC2. And that's why we are here. Chris is the author of the book Microservices Patterns. And today we are talking about service templates and service chassis. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, well, thanks for inviting me. It's good to talk.
Good. Did I forget to mention anything about you?
No, thank you. I know, have it covered. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add is that, you know, I sort of, my business is consulting and training, so I help companies adopt microservice architecture. And so if companies need help, please reach out to me.
Okay. Okay, so service templates, service chassis, they are the solution. But what is actually the problem? Before we dive into the solution, so what is the problem they are trying to solve?
You know, it's really funny you should ask that, because I was just looking at microservices.io and I realized that when I wrote the pattern there, I actually didn't define the problem. So, which is like really awkward, right? Because the whole point of a pattern is that it's a solution to a problem. but yeah, I guess sort of you, and one way of thinking about the problem is, well, how do you enable a developer to quickly start the development of a new service? Yeah, that's sort of fundamentally the issue you're trying to solve. I mean, in reality, you could say there's bigger things like, oh, we got to set up the GitHub repository. We've got to set up the deployment pipeline. So there are some additional things. But, you know, when it comes to writing actual code, right, your job as a developer is basically, I want to write some business logic, right? I want to just put, you know, implement a business capability. But in order to do that, you've got to like create a project with all of the code and, you know, and then there's numerous things, right? Just like configuring all of the Gradle dependencies. That's one thing, right? Which in itself is a non-trivial problem, right? Like assembling a consistent set of Java dependencies that actually work together seems to be a really hard problem these days, right? You've also got to configure Gradle appropriately to set up all of the appropriate tasks, right? Then there's configuring the frameworks that you're using, and setting up like data source connections and so on. So admittedly, something like Spring Boot with its auto configuration takes care of a bunch of that, and that's a good start, but usually you need a lot more than that. And then, you know, there's just sort of in a microservice architecture, there's a whole bunch of cross-cutting concerns that you typically need to implement. You know, whether that's say, okay, I've got a service with a REST API, I have to implement security, require all API access to be authenticated with a JWT, for example, right? You know, that could be a standard for your application architecture. Implement observability, right? Which is basic stuff like a health check, but, you know, also include things like distributed tracing, persistence, logging, all of that basic stuff. And then finally, once you've got all that in place, you can start writing some business logic.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I mean, 2 days ago, I had this kind of onboarding with a new team. And, you know, everything you said, and then I was like, oh, you know, and we also, you know, we use Argo CD for GitOps. Do you know that? You know, And you have to do that to deploy to a sandbox. And then you have to do license scanning and security analysis, dynamic and static, and all those kind of things. And everyone was like, okay, oh, my head is exploding. I just want to deploy in Hello World.
Yeah. So, and just actually getting, you know, it's just getting a set of Java dependencies and the right versions that work together. That can be a deeply frustrating experience, right? And then things like, you know, we had the log4j problem, right? And that requires a dependency upgrade, right? You got to upgrade to a new version of log4j, which then sort of actually could trigger an upgrade of Spring Boot, which then actually the new version of Spring Boot requires a new version of Gradle. Right, because it's like the Spring Boot plugin has version as dependencies on the Gradle version. So, you know, sounds simple, but there's just a bunch of work involved, right?
Yeah.
Do
you also consider? So, do you consider the problem, let's say, related to everything which is in the deployment artifact, or are you also looking at, you know, maybe I need performance tests and I need to understand how I write those performance tests for my service, or if I want to connect to a database, if I have microservices, I probably get my secrets from a secret store. So how do I get those out of a secret store? And, you know, there is a lot of code which is not really part of the deployment unit, but more of deployment pipeline, or maybe even other artifacts like tests.
Oh yeah, I guess all of the above, right? So it's, you know, in a sense, what you need to create is a Git repository that contains sort of everything needed, and that, for example, could actually configure the deployment pipeline, right? Like for instance, I use CircleCI. So there's a .CircleCI directory that configures the pipeline, or a GitHub Actions directory, right? So on and so forth. So it's all of that stuff, including tests, right? The test support classes, testing strategies. And there can even sort of be architectural concerns like, okay, as an organizational standard, we're going to use the hexagonal architecture, right? So a simplistic project, it would just be, you know, source main Java, right? Whereas a more elaborate project, it would be a multi-module Gradle or Maven project, where you've got a domain directory, right? That's the core business logic. Then you have modules for each of the adapter class adapters, like web messaging, database access, and so on. So even just setting up that kind of consistent structure and tying that back in with the build logic is another thing that you have to do, right? And just to go hello world, right?
Yeah. And I mean, In the monolith days, we had to do the same, but we just did it once, right? And then it was done. It was just done. We could start. But in the microservice world, we do it for one service. What is with the next service?
Yeah.
Right.
With the monolith, obviously, you just have one deployable unit, right? So you could say one repo, whereas the microservice architecture, you've got multiple deployable units. And one obvious thing to do, which I guess I did in the monolithic world perhaps, was I want to start something new, I just copy paste from an existing project, right? So you can do that, but you know, sort of that kind of copy paste plus just gratuitous differences between services based on the, say, the whim of the developer at that particular point in time just creates a lot of inconsistencies, and there's a lot of work, right? So one solution to this problem is the service template pattern. And that's basically, you could say it's a hello world service, a repository containing a hello world service that you can just clone and immediately start developing your application, your services business logic. And it just takes care of everything. It's got the build logic, the deployment pipeline configuration, all of the code and the configuration for the cross-cutting concerns, plus some sample application logic as well.
Mm.
So you can just hit the ground running, right?
Yeah. So if I have to spin up a new service, I don't have to spend days or weeks even to get all the things we mentioned in the beginning to get that running. I just clone the repository and that's it.
Yeah.
So that actually, it sounds pretty cool, right? So I have to say, I'm a big service template fan. Yeah. In every project, when I start a microservice project, I start with a service template. But I also run into problems with the service template, because once I created it, it of course evolves. So I have my service, my hello world, and then I give it to team A, and I give it to team B, and I give it to team C, and then we are in the project for some time. How can I avoid those kind of drifts that I have my, today I develop a version, and in 3 months' time, I know, I could have done better with this service template. I have actually a few changes which makes it easier to use and stuff like that. But it's difficult to propagate all the changes to all the people who already used it.
Yeah. So each time you start a new service, you're basically taking a point in time snapshot of your service template repository, which is likely to evolve over time. I mean, it could just simply be, we're upgrading our set of dependencies, right? Like, log4j emergency.
Exactly. Right? Simple example, yeah.
So that's great. You've updated your service template, but all of the instantiations of it are still running the old version. It doesn't help that. So there is this disconnect. One possibility is that the actual services are forks of the service template repo. So in theory, you could sort of do a git pull to refresh, to pull the latest version and update it that way. So you could sort of leverage git in order to minimize the work, right?
No.
So that's definitely one possibility. But if you take a step back and you can view the service template as glorified copy-paste programming, right? And,
That's how I do it.
Yes, I know.
Glorified copy-paste.
It's the way of Googling, doing a Google search and copy and pasting is how most development is done today, right? But it's generally a bad thing, right? I mean, eventually you realize, we shouldn't keep copy-pasting the same thing. Instead, we should create an abstraction, right? And so the idea then is that then leads to this microservice chassis pattern. So that is a framework that contains sort of most of the build logic, most of the code and implement and configuration of the cross-cutting concerns, And the service template is a much smaller Hello World application that just depends upon the framework and depends literally in the sort of gray or maven sense of the word, right? So your service template is this small thing. Then when you instantiate it, your services are referencing a particular version of the microservice chassis. So then that means that ideally a change, you know, you make a change to the chassis, you then simply have to bump the version that in each of the services, right? You know, one line change, and those services just automatic then will then just get the new version.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing, would you recommend doing that already from the beginning on, when we are still a little bit unsure how, you know, those libraries should look like? Maybe in my first version, the first version is not perfectly well.
Yeah. I mean, I could argue it both ways. I'm sort of on the one hand, you shouldn't design frameworks up front. They should really evolve from kind of your experience, right? From 30 years ago, there was sort of this rule, like, you should basically write three applications and then actually create a framework that abstracts out the commonalities, right? So you want to be careful with big upfront design. And then things that make me really nervous is sometimes I talk with organizations where it's like, yeah, we're going to build this framework and we're going to build tooling around it. And they haven't even implemented any services yet. Right.
Okay.
Number one, you should actually have services working, right? But then very quickly, you should be aware of the copy-paste sort of issue. And then, you know, be prepared to quickly iterate on this frame, on this chassis concept.
Okay.
You just don't want to over-engineer any of this stuff, right?
Yeah,
and exactly. Then, you know, there's a tendency in organizations to create a platform team that does all this fancy stuff, but that's sort of doing it backwards, right? You know, minimum viable platform concept, so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's tricky. Yeah. So I would just start with good old copy paste and let's see to get something working, get some experience, have a few services trying it out. And at some point when we feel, okay, now we learned enough, we could just start with, building, let's say, the framework or the libraries.
Yeah. But you don't want to leave it too late. Right. And you know, that, cause that's, otherwise, you're just creating a lot of technical debt.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, was it Neil Ford or Rebecca Parsons saying the last responsible moment or something? That is really hard to find, you know. Usually, I'm always like, oops, I missed that last responsible moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so now we have our template. We spread it around across the organization. A couple of teams adopted it. We got some feedback. So now we built libraries and we have a nice chassis. And now I just realize, okay, we have a new version of some library. Of our template or our of the, let's say, the our Hello World application. And I'm wondering, how do I get, what should I do then? Because I know the Google problem, you know, Google and I believe also the Dutch bank ING, they copied that approach, that they say, look, currently you are using library XYZ, yeah, in version 2.1, and we are going to deprecate it in 6 months or in 3 months. So you have to update to a newer version in the next couple of months, right? Because after that, it won't be available in our, let's say, Artifactory, for example. I always found that quite hard, yeah, to just say, if you don't update the library, you know, nothing will work. And also the complaints I hear is that teams are quite busy constantly updating libraries instead of implementing business logic. Is that a correct observation, or what would you recommend with updating those libraries?
Yeah. I think there is this tension because, yeah, I just want to work on my business logic, right? But at the same time, there's things keep changing, right? I mean, new versions of various libraries come out. And then there's sort of cascading dependencies, right, as well. One issue I encountered the other day was, I think it was like, okay, I had a project that built with a Gradle project that built with various versions of Java, but I hadn't tried it out with Gradle set with Java 17, right? And then when I tried it with Java 17, Gradle got this error, right? And then it turns out that, you know, you got to upgrade to some newer version of Gradle, you know, but then I was using some old version, and then I'd ignored the deprecation warnings about this feature that you're using, right? You know, like the way you define your dependencies. So you upgrade to a new version of Gradle, then you've got to go through and change all of your build.gradle files, right? So that was one scenario where upgrading Gradle to support a new version of the JVM, you know, created some issues. Another way is, as I mentioned earlier, you update Spring Boot. That has, you know, the Spring Boot plugin has dependencies on a particular version of Gradle or later. So if you upgrade Spring Boot, then that triggers an update of Gradle. So my big takeaway from that is you kind of have to stay reasonably current, right? Because, you know, mm-hmm. worst case scenario is, you know, in particular, like going back to this Log4j fiasco, right? You know, the easiest way to fix that in a Spring Boot application is just update to Spring Boot 2.6.2. Right. And you need to do that quickly. Right. But then that relies on having a whole bunch of other dependencies that are including the Gradle version that are reasonably current. So sadly, I think it's sort of a fact of life that you need to stay reasonably current just so that you can sort of react quickly to security fixes or anything, you know, and other things like that. So once again, one hopes that this microservice chassis framework can help, right? Because the chassis kind of defines in one place all of this sort of all of the dependencies, including, say, the Gradle wrapper version, the Spring Boot version that you're using, and so on. So in order to upgrade to the latest and greatest, you just have to upgrade to the latest chassis.
Now,
fingers crossed. Now, hopefully your service, one of the issues with a chassis is that if you're, you know, you could say it's an opinionated framework, right? So if the way what your service, you know, if your service needs to do things that don't quite fit with the framework, then there's sort of a, there could be a potential mismatch.
But yeah, but I'm just wondering, because that happens quite often, and I'm just wondering if that is, you know, how big is that problem? So I stole that from a German guy, Christian Deger. He once said, you know, we have this principle which we call follow the trail. You know, we have a service template, and the service template is kind of the trail which goes through the jungle. So if you follow the trail, your life will be easy. But maybe in some circumstances, this trail is not for you. And then you have to go through the jungle, and then things become obviously very complicated for you because there is no trail in the jungle. And you have to come up with a lot of things by yourself, which like a chassis is already giving you. And then you have to develop it by yourself. Yeah. And, but that's then your decision, if that's just how it is.
Yeah. I mean, maybe. I mean, it's sort of hard to talk about in the abstract, but maybe the chassis is could be a sort of, I'm going to wave my hands and say modular, so that enables you to sort of reuse parts of it as much as possible for your unique service.
Yeah, I mean, that is, of course, then ideal, right? So you just skip certain, let's say, parts of it and and use them.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing. So obviously, if we use a chassis, things are getting consistent, right? So that's also something I like with that approach is. We have something like, let's say, governance as code, I would say. You know, if you start a project, you have to develop all those concepts, but concepts rely somewhere, you know, if they are written down, if they're documented, that's good. But it's better if you also can show a code.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, that's... Yeah, what's your experience with that? So should you see it as an, let's say, opinionated guidance, which you can, let's say, take or leave? Or is it something where you say people should always follow that, or the consultant answer? It depends.
Well, you know, I think in the context of, say, the microservice architecture, right? Like, in order to be a production-ready service, a service has to implement a certain set of attributes, right? Like API secured through a JWT. And then logging or observability and so on, right? So there's sort of a set of rules that a service has to follow in order to be a good citizen within this application and inside your organization, right?
No.
That's a set of non-negotiable rules that can be written down. And yeah, going back to your point about following the path through the jungle, right? You know, the chassis is really that path that makes it easier to follow. And generally, you should just follow it, right? But, you know, if you don't want to, well, you have to go read the list of rules and implement them the hard way. But you really should have a darn good reason for doing something different. Because on the one hand, I think teams should be autonomous, but at the same time, they should not just go make gratuitous choices, right? I mean, every decision that you make should be defensible, and sort of should at some level get buy-in from the rest of the other, well, the organization at some level, right?
Hmm. Yeah, I had an interesting discussion a couple of weeks ago where people said, oh, you know, our goal is to have the highest autonomy for our teams. And I was like, no, I don't think so. Because one team, they basically built their own platform by themselves. So we offer a platform and they just said, you know what? We are not interested in this Kubernetes stuff. We just do our own thing, you know, with the lambdas and all that. And I said, look, autonomous teams are not the goal. The goal is to be fast, right? And if you're totally autonomous and you do everything by yourself, you're not fast. So if you follow the trail, you are fast. So maybe you should follow the trail.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I feel like you need to achieve a balance between kind of conforming to the rules and autonomy. Right.
No.
And one of the most interesting examples of this was a few years ago, I was at the DevOps Enterprise Summit, and there was a talk by some people at Target about how they manage their technology roadmap, right? You know, like the list of technologies that you can use within your organization.
Mm.
And this was, you know, like the traditional way of doing this is, yeah, you've got some, you know, big-brained architects that you have to go and beg and plead, and a year later they're approved the use of some technology that everyone else has been using for, you know, 3 years, right? but with Target, they had a really interesting scheme where, and it sort of leveraged GitHub, actually. So the list of approved technologies was a GitHub repo. And you could submit a pull request saying, I want, you know, to actually change the list of approved technologies. And then that would trigger the usual PR review mechanism, where the rest of the organization got to debate. You know, you actually had to debate the suggested thing, right? And so it was sort of consensus based, and you'd hope that people would be quite rational about this, right? And it was sort of interesting, and the level of agreement needed depended upon the sort of the impact of the technology that you were adopting. So if you were proposing a new database, that probably went up to the CIO level. And I think they, you know, they reviewed that monthly or quarterly, right? But if it was some random JavaScript framework, the other JavaScript developers could go, yeah, sure, right? And to me, that was a great way of sort of, you know, managing technology within your organization. So it was very grassroots, bottom-up driven for the most part. Because, you can have problems. I mean, like one example, I was doing an architecture review for this client, and their primary technology was JVM, and maybe it was MySQL, right? That was their sort of technology stack. But one developer just decided to create a Rust Postgres-based service. Just because, right? And it's kind of interesting, but organizationally, it's like, what the heck? You know, it's like you've incurred the organizational overhead of supporting yet another database type, which is, and you can debate the merits, but, you know, Postgres, MySQL, right? I mean, you pick one. You don't have both, right? Mm.
No.
And then you've picked a non-JVM language. It's like, why?
Yeah, you always find reasons, right? If you want to try out a new technology, but it's only does it really help the client, right? It's probably it only helps this developer interested in Rust.
Yeah. So whereas if that company had applied, say, the target model, he would have submitted a pull request and saying, I want to use Postgres, and the answer would probably have been no. I would want to use Rust, and the answer would probably be no too, right? Unless there was some unique requirements like super low latency, couldn't incur the overhead of garbage collection, therefore Rust is okay, right? Whereas another more reasonable example would say, okay, I know we've been using Java, but hey, let's have a look at Kotlin, right? Because you do want to experiment with new technologies, but you want to have technology candidates that are sort of justifiable, right? And Kotlin would be something to experiment with. And hopefully the rest of the organization would be, oh yeah, sure, try it out.
So in the target model, who you said about a database, some C-level person decides, and about JavaScript frameworks, is it then the front-end community, or who decides what to adopt there?
Yeah, some more or less something like that. I can't remember the details. But you could imagine that depending on, the greater the impact of a particular technology, the higher up it needed to go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I will look up the talk and also put it in the show notes.
Yeah, it's like Target Dojo Technology Governance, something like that. DevOps Enterprise Summit.
Okay. Cool. So I look it up. One thing I was also struggling ever since with my service templates. Actually, I only did service templates, no chassis. Was not adapting like a product management mindset. We developed it, we threw it to the teams. Of course, we tried to collect some feedback. But now in hindsight, I think, so the documentation was pretty good. I have the feeling a little bit more product management would have been better all the time. So offering also, let's say, quote unquote, professional services and establish some, feedback cycle with the development teams and things like that. What do you think about this product management mindset? Is it necessary? And if yes, how much?
Yeah. Good question. I mean, maybe it just depends the degree of it, But it's this interesting thing where in some ways it's a service template and chassis is sort of kind of non-trivial in many ways. And yes, it probably needs good documentation. It probably needs an owner. Maybe there's like across an organization, there's just like a community of practice of people who from multiple teams who contribute to the chassis, but as opposed to having a dedicated chassis team, I kind of feel like that's probably overkill, right? But yeah. Having a bunch of people who sort of have ownership of that, I think makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so either it could be, let's say, part of the platform team, but maybe better is the a couple of developers from each team who try to maintain it.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I guess it just depends, like how much, you know, is it a full-time job? Probably not, right? No. I mean, but it's one of those periodic things, right? Where, once again, going back to the log4j problem, yeah, you would have been really busy. There's a lot of people who are, well, they're probably still super busy dealing with that mess, right? But that, you know, so then, you know, then there's issues with balancing the needs of like feature development with the needs for chassis development. And certainly in some, this case, chassis development takes priority over everything else, right?
Hmm. Good. Any dangers you see when applying service chassis?
Well, maybe the issue is it's more sort of an organizational thing where if it's really, and this is sort of generic issue with platforms, right? Where if it really is sort of a bottom-up approach where the chassis and the template evolve, you know, it's very much driven by the needs of the team, right? I think that's a good thing. Whereas if, let's imagine you have the platform team that just there's a risk of over-engineering it, and imposing this overly complex solution on the development team, right? I mean, I feel like, yeah, once again, I mean, this is sort of a platform anti-pattern, right?
Yeah.
I would worry about that.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, true. You see it and you think, okay, I'm not going to use it because it's too complex. And yeah.
And, you know, once again, it's, you know, I feel like there's, I think, it, you know, we tend to gravitate towards technology and towards, you know, platform stuff because it's kind of, it's nice, it's exciting and it's tangible, whereas business rules and users, oh, those are messy, nebulous things, right? So, yeah, that. You know, so there is the risk of that. But I mean, we always need to remember that the focus is basically on, you know, in a sense, it's implementing our domain logic, right? That's what we're, and well, you could say the UI, the user experience, right? Those two things are what's important. And everything else is just sort of supporting stuff.
True.
Remarkably, there's a lot of stuff just to, you know, like the hexagonal architecture, right? All the stuff around your, you know, on the outside of your services is like, can be quite complicated, even though it's fairly boring in relation to the actual business logic that you're implementing.
Do you see any... Are there any criteria from, let's say, an organizational size when I should start to think about it? I mean, I could imagine if we are 10 people in the project and we just write a couple of services, we are just good to go with copy paste or something. But if we are 150 people or 500 people, it's probably better to adopt this approach.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, in many ways, the organizational size kind of ties back to whether you should be using microservice architecture or not, right? Like, for the most part, you know, the microservice architecture is when you have a team of teams developing services, right? And yeah, I suppose you could say if you just got a handful of services, probably not. But once you get 10 or more, and you know, it starts the need just grows probably super linearly with the number of services you have.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If you are what is it, the Monzo Bank with 400 microservices, they probably have something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's the service granularity is a super interesting issue. Like, I'm very much in favor of just having a service per team, right? Unless there's a really good reason for having more, right? And there's various motivations for having more, like, oh, we need to use a mixture of languages, right? Our fraud detection service is, yeah, most of it's in Java, but then we've got the machine learning model executing in Python, right? Two services there, right? One team. But interestingly, what I've noticed is there's a really common, what I would argue, anti-pattern of having a service per developer. you talk to a team and it's like, you know, three people. Well, let's say five people. Each one of them have their own service, and it's almost like the team is really itself a team of one person teams, right? You know, and each one's responsible. And a lot of that just comes from taking the service metaphor or concept just too far, right? You know, there's a lot of things that should just be a library or module, right? Don't just automatically turn it into a service. Because you have a service template and chassis that makes it easy to spin up a new service.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, one service per developer is a super common anti-pattern that I've just seen in numerous organizations. And then Monzo Bank, that's even better, right? I mean, I think it's like, ten services per developer? And I'm
I don't
sure
know, but it's a lot of, they have a lot of services. Yeah,
I think at one point they had 150 people, 1,500 services, right?
Ah, okay, and, even more. Okay.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's good reasons. So I don't want them yelling at me. But it's not a model that I would recommend to an organization.
Just don't copy paste the solution if you don't have the same problem. No.
Yes. Yeah.
So I have one last question, and I call it specific hassles. So Netflix, they just said everything which is deployed in our infrastructure has to run on a JVM. And the Monzo Bank says you have to use Go, for example. But what about companies which just say, you know, you can use any technology you want, or you can use, let's say, you can use Java, Go, and JavaScript, and you can run your stuff on, you know, Elastic Kubernetes Service and AWS, you can use AWS Lambda. Is it still worth thinking about service chassis if you need to support lots of languages, or at least more than one language or more than one platform?
I think the short answer is yes, with the assumption that, I guess, sort of in a sense, you end up with needing to have multiple chassis, multiple templates, right?
Mm.
Yeah. For Java, for Golang, and then for sort of particular environments as well.
Yeah, which is a lot of extra work. And you
I feel like for that reason, I mean, there's sort of a number of thoughts, right? Like, certainly when it comes to languages, I feel like you should you just in general want to make your technology choices in a very careful way, right? And you shouldn't make kind of gratuitous, arbitrary decisions like, oh, I'm just going to use Elixir for this just because I feel like it, right? I mean, it's fun, but you know, from a business point of view, it's not helpful, right? It's not a good approach. Plus, it actually ends up incurring a lot of cost, right? Because, if you pick some unsupported language, then you go back to the problem that the service template solves, right? Oh, we got to implement all this build logic, this cross-cutting concern stuff, so on and so forth, right? And that's a lot of overhead. So, I mean, you really need to make a sort of wise technology choices. And most organizations do. I mean, I remember I have talked with companies that, historical reasons, half the company was using Java and half of it was using Python to basically implement business level services. And that just seemed like less than ideal. You really need to pick one. Right. Yeah. And, you know, and then like say Python, excellent choice for anything involving math and machine learning and that kind of thing. Right. But to have, you know, your order management logic implemented in Python and then your delivery management logic implemented in Java, why, you know?
Yeah, but I, you know, the thing is, or actually to me, it feels like one of the big sells of microservices is you, there is some sort of macro architecture, you know, that is, everyone needs to follow that macro architecture, but on the micro level in your service, certain things you're just free to choose. And yeah, people just say, okay, I just want to use the language I want to use, you know, and if I want to use white space or brainfuck, you know, why not? And
yeah,
I mean, now extreme, yeah. Of course, nobody's doing that, but let's say I want to.
Oh, no. Someone is using that. Okay. No, I mean, you're right. I mean, in a purely technical sense, right? Provided the service is a good citizen within the application architecture, and provided it implements the necessary API, then everything else about it is a technical detail that is encapsulated and free to change, and you could make gratuitous decisions, right?
Hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, from an organizational point of view, I mean, there's sort of these non-technical issues like staffing, right? You know, I mean, like one client I worked with a few years ago, they had a Scala stack, right? And it was, you know, it worked well for them, except in the geography where they were based, they couldn't hire any Scala developers. And the whole team was actually a bunch of expats from other countries, right? And that sounds great. You know, that kind of situation is great when you're small, but imagine you get a whole ton of VC and you want to rapidly scale up to hundreds of developers. You can't manufacture 100 Scala developers if there are none, right? And so it doesn't even matter the technical merits of the technology, right? Like, it doesn't matter that Scala supports monads and effects and other functional, I'm going to call it mumbo jumbo, right? When you can't hire the people, right? Apologies to the functional programming community. But, you know, so from an engineering, from an organizational point of view, using Java for all of its boring warts, right, and its lack of monads, functors, and God knows what else, that's a much better choice, because you can go out and hire 100 Java developers and actually build product that you can sell.
Yeah, that's true,
right? And that's a huge, you know, that's a huge concern. Or, you know, one person knows one technology and they leave. You know, that's a problem for the organization, right? So, you know, or say, or like with your cert, I mean, another example, right, is you pick a certain kind of database from the API level, makes no difference, right? The database is encapsulated. But from the operational perspective, right, you know, the ops team now have to manage that database, right? So it's not just the concern of the development team, it's now a concern of the platform team as well.
Yeah, so
there are these broader issues that kind of constrain, you know, really constrain the technology choices that you can make.
Yeah, it's something, let's say, some people don't want to hear, right? So, constrain technology choices. But I agree. I mean, in one project I've been, it was not actually programming languages, but they said, oh, we have no environment, but we have all those teams developing their services, but they all do it in their own little sandbox, but there is no integration environment or no production yet. And, you know, everyone is free to choose the deployment pipeline of their choice. And for me, it was like, no, you know, we have no time. We have to hurry up. We have to do this in 2 weeks. And if everyone is busy 2 weeks choosing an appropriate technology for deploying, we are going nowhere. So we constrained now the choice to, back in the days, GitLab CI. So everyone has to use it. And that's, you know, it's fine. So then we are fast. But it was not really, yeah, what has been sold, let's say, to the people. Sold was free technology choice. But it, yeah. I would say in a lot of cases, it makes no sense. Without constraints, you're not going nowhere. All right. Cool. So, yeah, my questions are answered, I have to say. Thank you very much. I go with, let's say I start my day tomorrow with a fresh view on service templates. Actually, currently I'm working on one, so have to overthink a couple of things after we talked.
Oh, good. I'm glad this was useful.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, another plug is I actually have a Manning Life project series, which is currently in beta, and the goal of the Life project series is actually to first build a microservice template or a service template, and then a later project actually refactors it into a chassis and so extracts the chassis out of the template. So hopefully that will be available from Manning soon.
Okay, cool.
And creating that was actually really thought-provoking. Just sort of, it's like, gave me a lot of stuff to think about, which, you know, a lot of the ideas I brought up today kind of were crystallized by going through that exercise.
Okay, cool. When do you expect it to be available?
That's a good question. I don't know the time frame. I mean, it's like it's in beta, right? Well, like actually the beta might be finishing any day now, actually.
Okay.
So real soon.
Cool. So yeah, I maybe I ask next week or 2 weeks for a link. Or is that too early?
Yeah, I don't know the publisher's process, because this first time creating a live project. So it's all, you know, different workflow from creating a book.
Yeah. All right, cool. So, I want to thank you. I want to thank our listeners. And Chris, have a nice day.
Yeah, Thanks. You know, it's 8:15 in the morning. The sun is shining. So pretty good. Thanks. I enjoyed the discussion. Thank you.